The murder of Juanita Nielsen was an iconic event in Sydney and Australia. It's a story wrapped up in politics, greed and corruption.
It was on the front page of the Daily Mirror. Heiress missing, it said.
In this episode, we go back to the original police files to reveal how a major murder investigation was derailed from the very start.
How many police were being paid?
How much time have you got?
We'll take a close look at the three main suspects.
I get blamed for so many things.
Did you keep two sets of books to keep track of this black and white cash?
I did.
And we answer the most difficult question. Just who ordered the killing of Juanita Nielsen?
That's a revelation. You've changed my thinking completely. It makes total sense.
This is 202 Victoria Street, Potts Point. Juanita Nielsen once lived here, and an endless spring of myths have grown up around the circumstances of her disappearance and presumed murder in 1975.
In the 70s in Sydney, Juanita Nielsen was well known and well connected. She came from old money as an heiress to the Mark Foy's retail fortune. However, she chose to live amongst the bohemians and sex workers of King's Cross.
My name is David Farrell, and in the early 70s, I was Juanita's business partner and life partner. It was the age of the hippies and free love.
The permissive age?
Yes, absolutely. Our relationship was an open relationship.
Together, David and Juanita produced a community newspaper called Now.
Originally, Now newspaper was supporting small business. The people with the dress shop or the candle shop or the craft shop or the chemist or whatever. And she would write personal, interesting stories about the human aspects of all these businesses. There wasn't much money in the newspaper, and Juanita didn't have much money. She wasn't living the life of an heiress in any way. She didn't have a car. Her father had bought her the house at 202 Victoria Street. Juanita had always been conscious of the little people. When we lived in 202 Victoria Street, we'd talk to anyone, whether they were a prostitute walking up the road or an artist or an eccentric of some kind.
But Victoria Street was changing before Juanita's eyes. A wealthy businessman, Frank Tiemann, who'd made a fortune as a clothing manufacturer, turned his hand to property developing. In the early 70s, he spent nearly $6 million buying up a lot of houses in Victoria Street. And you can see the attraction. It's a high-set street with spectacular views to the city. This is premium Sydney real estate.
Final plan involves a great improvement for the street, and there'll be a new development facing the city.
Frank Tiemann's original plan was to tear everything down, including a row of historic houses, to build three 45-storey apartment blocks, a 15-storey office block, and a car park.
Sydney at that time was undergoing a huge building boom because there was a very pro-development, corrupt Bob Askin government. There was no legislation at all to protect buildings. There was no Environment Act, no Heritage Act. So there was absolute impunity about what developers did. You know, if you owned Captain Cook's cottage, you could pull it down and put up high-rise. And so Frank Tiemann's project to just pull down all those beautiful old mansions in Victoria Street and put up executive apartments, he would have seen as just going ahead.
But the residents of Victoria Street had other ideas. They formed an action group with a simple message for Tiemann.
Look, developers don't own the city.
Just because you might own the property doesn't mean you own the city. The city's belongs to everyone.
Tiemann had a problem. He'd staked everything he owned on his $40 million redevelopment of Victoria Street. He was in serious debt, and it was a fight he couldn't afford to lose.
It was all about Tiemann and his development. He was losing millions of dollars for every year that that development wasn't happening. His interest charges were just enormous.
Tiemann hired thugs to intimidate the residents to leave their homes.
The other day, one of the tenants was visited, coincidentally, by a man with a crowbar over his shoulder who tried to pin him down to a date to leave.
To help them in their fight, the residents' action group sought and received help from Jack Mundy's Builders and Labourers Federation, the BLF. They issued a green ban on Frank Tiemann's development. However, the corrupt Askin state government colluded with the developers to deregister the BLF, clearing the way for Tiemann.
And then they moved in with a huge squad of police and Tiemann's goons.
Mr. Tiemann has moved in gangsters under the protection of the police.
They smashed their way in, hauled us all off, arrested us all and hauled us away.
I want to see them here with me.
Bring her, kids, for Christ's sake.
Oh,
even though some very brave people ended up standing up on the chimneys right on the top of the building. They were pulling the doors down, they were throwing them onto trucks and driving them off. They were making the buildings impossible to live in. And I still remember standing there on the pavement. We were sort of crying because we knew that they'd sort of won.
Contrary to popular opinion, Juanita Nielsen wasn't involved in the battle for Victoria Street in 1973. She was a blue blood who voted Liberal, and she had her own vision of how the Cross should be redeveloped.
She had started a newspaper a few years earlier in the expectation that the whole area would become gentrified, that it would become like another Double Bay, right? But I think it dawned on her as the various proposals came up that her idea wasn't going to happen. And so at that point, she started to shift her position and we all became closer together.
What happened to the Cross was what has happened to all of Sydney, what has happened to the Quay. There's just too much money around. There's very little of the old Cross now. The spirit has almost entirely gone because the people have gone.
Juanita's next move was to establish a relationship with the Secretary of the Water and Sewerage Employees Union, John Glebe.
She was working with John Glebe to get him to agree that his union would put a green ban and be the final knife in Frank Tiemann's development.
Juanita Nielsen kept the pressure on Tiemann's development through the pages of her newspaper Now. But editorials don't pay the bills. So on the morning of July 4th, 1975, Juanita left her home in Victoria Street and came here to discuss advertising. It's called the Empire Hotel now, but back in the 70s, it was a nightclub called the Carousel Club, and it was one of many businesses owned or controlled by Abe Saffron and managed by his trusted lieutenant, Big Jim Anderson.
The meeting to discuss advertising at the Carousel was scheduled for 10:30 a.m.
That day, she rang me early in the morning to say that she was going off to the Carousel and then going around Oxford Street to do various things, and that she'd keep in touch. Would ring me later in the afternoon to organise dinner.
Juanita never rang. Thinking he'd been stood up, Farrell went out for dinner with friends.
I didn't know what had happened to her. The next morning, I was ringing and ringing all over the place. I rang the Carousel. I'd rang everyone that she had in her address book that I could find, and got absolutely nowhere.
Farrell teamed up with union leader John Glebe, and together they went to Darlinghurst Police Station.
We more or less got the brush off. To say, oh, well, she'll turn up. Lots of people go missing around here and don't worry about it. The next morning, I got a visit from some of the people from the Victoria Street Action Group saying, hey, you better watch what's going on. You better get to the police at a higher level, which I did. Within an hour, it was on for young and old.
Coming up...
They cornered us, beat us up and took us to the cops.
Why the police investigation was doomed to fail.
Honest policemen, they're like rocking horse shit.
It's Saturday, July 5th, 1975, and Sydney's waking up to the news that one of its elites has disappeared. Has she been kidnapped? Has she been murdered? And if so, by whom?
And I was out for lunch and bought the paper, and there it was on the front of page of the Daily Mirror. Heiress missing, it said, that was it.
Barry Ward lives in England now, but in 1975, he was working in Sydney as a journalist for the Daily Telegraph. He met Juanita socially a couple of times.
And she was just a nice, kind person. I thought she was very attractive. A very elegant lady, too.
And she told you of her campaign to save Victoria Street.
Yes, that's right. That's really how, I guess, how it all began. I went up to King's Cross and Juanita had told me about the action group, so I found a couple of people who were involved in that and got the background of what was happening up there. But then it just grew from there.
She formed a partnership with another journalist.
Yes, that was Tony Reeves.
Police began their investigation at the Carousel Club, so that's where Tony and Barry started theirs as well. They wanted to find Eddie Trigg, the manager of the Carousel's VIP bar, who Juanita was going to meet on the day she disappeared.
So you went to try to see Trigg. What happened?
Well, we went to the Carousel one evening to find him, and he wasn't there. We traced him to the Laramie, which was a restaurant at the top of William Street. Tried to interview him, but as soon as we mentioned Juanita's name, he went ballistic, which seemed a good opportunity to leave. But they cornered us in one of those side streets and beat us up and took us to the cops. They pulled up at Darlinghurst Police Station. Trigg went into the police station and a second later came out with the sergeant who leaned in the car and said, get out, you're under arrest. And they arrested us for being drunk.
And were you drunk?
No. But yeah, they threw us into the slammer overnight, threw us into jail, and there we were. We still were still fearful because it was fairly obvious to us then that the cops had been expecting us. Later proved a Trigg had called Anderson, who'd called the cops. And this is a fact. We were able to prove it.
Jim Anderson was Eddie Trigg's boss.
And Tony said, will Mr. Trigg's name be appearing on the charge sheet? And that's when the sergeant said, Mr. Trigg is a figment of your imagination. He doesn't exist. There's obviously a very close relationship between the people at the Carousel and the Darlinghurst police. Right.
So the Carousel was almost like a little doorway into the corrupt heart of what was going on within police and government in Sydney at the time.
Very much so.
Peter Rees is another journalist who's taken a lifetime interest in the Juanita Nielsen case. The first person I want to ask him about is Eddie Trigg.
Eddie Trigg was born in 1940 and he was an uncontrollable child. He went to Mount Penang Children's Home. And he quickly got a criminal record. He was a violent man. He was a psychopath, according to his ex-wife. He was brutal.
And his boss was Jim Anderson, who took violence and intimidation to a whole new level.
Tell us about Big Jim Anderson.
Well, Anderson was a former Marine, British Marine, Royal Marine. And then he came to Australia where he began running clubs. His first probably big job was running Venus Room, managing the Venus Room for Abe Saffron. Now, he was king hit by a Sydney criminal by the name of Donnie Smith, Iron Glove Smith.
Why was he called the Glove?
Well, he always wore a lethal weapon on his left hand, which was plaster of Paris and lead and a glove. He did hit me, by the way. It was the best hit I've ever had. It broke my jaw, knocked all my lovely teeth out, and tried to get my gun and found out it wasn't good enough, and I shot him straight through the heart.
There was no trial. There was no build. So Anderson learns from this, hey, I can kill people and get away with it.
So if you're getting the picture that Sydney is a town where you could get away with anything, including murder, well, you'd be right. But to understand how the police investigation into Juanita Nielsen's disappearance was derailed almost from the start, you really need to understand a bit more about the man who ran Sleaze and Vice in the Cross for more than four decades, Abe Saffron.
Well, Abe was a man who rose to prominence in the period where American GIs were stationed in Sydney. They needed some extracurricular fun to be had, so Abe was very good at providing prostitutes, gambling, sly grogging.
I get blamed for so many things, and it's horrible that this should happen.
But why do you get blamed for so many things?
Yes, well, I don't know. Maybe you could tell me. You haven't met me till today.
Abe Saffron was able to hold great influence over people because of their sexual predilections. If they were police or perhaps judges or perhaps politicians, he would know all the gossip about them. And Abe had all of that information stored in his memory over 50 years. It created an environment where something like the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen could not be properly investigated.
I remember thinking, we need to talk to some police that we can trust. And I went and spoke to my solicitor, Jack Graham, and Jack just said, honest policemen, they're like rocking horse shit.
The Carousel Cabaret should have been, and would have been these days, declared a crime scene immediately. That did not happen.
Police spoke to Eddie Trigg at the Carousel Club 2 days after Juanita disappeared.
This is what Trigg told police. According to him, Juanita walked up the stairs of the club to the first floor at about 10:30 a.m. on the Friday. She was met by the club's receptionist, Loretta Crawford. Trigg then accompanied Juanita up the stairs to the second floor to the VIP bar, where they discussed the ad he wanted to place in Juanita's newspaper. This is the original report made by the investigator on the Nielsen case, Carl Arkins. Trigg states he paid her the sum of $130 in cash, for which she gave him a receipt from the notebook that she had with her. The receipt was handwritten by her, torn from the book and given to Trigg after she'd counted the money. She put the notebook and the money in her bag, and she was then escorted to the first floor landing by Trigg and then left the building.
Trigg's statement was not subjected to any scrutiny, and police followed a lead that Juanita was seen getting into a car after she left the Carousel Club.
Just before lunch, she left and returned to Darlinghurst Street and climbed into a yellow Falcon.
And that appeared to be the only angle police followed for the next 2 years, leading Barry Ward and Tony Reeves to believe the investigation was fixed.
How many more murders, how many more assaults, how many more deaths are we going to have before the government will act? Obviously, there's sufficient grounds for a Royal Commission or a very thorough inquiry of some sort.
With public pressure mounting, the police finally made a move. They charged Eddie Trigg and two other men with conspiracy to abduct Juanita Nielsen. But these charges weren't related to the meeting at the Carousel Club. They were for a visit Trigg made to Juanita's home 4 days before the appointment at the Carousel.
He knocked on the door and I was there. Juanita was in the next room. She hadn't had her makeup on, so she wasn't seeing anyone. And so I saw him in the front room. But she was in the next room. She heard everything. And he said, I'm the business manager of the Carousel. We're thinking of starting businessmen's lunches. We want to advertise in now. I want to see Mrs. Nielsen straight away. And I said, well, she's not available right now, and I'll go to get in touch with you. I've got the phone numbers or whatever. And he said, well, make sure she rings me. And that was about it.
That's how the meeting at the Carousel Club was arranged. 8 years after Juanita disappeared, Trigg pleaded guilty to the conspiracy to abduct charge. However, he was never charged with her murder.
There was no real incentive to solve Juanita Nielsen's murder. They had the fellas done on conspiracy, and it sort of stopped at that.
And this is almost textbook, right? That you're able to nail a couple of guys for minor charges, and the murders go on unsolved.
In 1983, an inquest into the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen was held. It ran for 13 weeks and 4 days. It was the longest inquest in the history of New South Wales.
So what did the inquest find? Well, nothing, other than Juanita was probably killed and that police inquiries might have been influenced by corruption. The whole thing was a once-over lightly by police, which led many to believe the fix was in, which it was.
Next, how Jim Anderson undermined the National Crime Authority.
What the NCA didn't realise was the nature of the man they were dealing with as their chief informant. Jim Anderson burnt them.
The only real benefit of the coroner's inquest into the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen was that it narrowed down the list of suspects to three. The property developer, Frank Tiemann, the boss of the Cross, Abe Saffron, and Saffron's second in command, Big Jim Anderson. Let's start with the theory that Frank Tiemann was the villain. This is championed by journalist Peter Rees.
Frank Tiemann was the main developer in Victoria Street. He'd bought up a huge number of houses, 50-odd houses. Jack Mundy's BLF applied green bans to Victoria Street, all of which meant that in a period of rising inflation, Frank Tiemann could not proceed. He was facing interest rate payments amounting to $1.1 million a year, with no prospect of recouping that money. He was looking down the barrel of huge losses.
Tiemann beat the BLF's green bans, but Peter Rees says Juanita was his last remaining threat as she'd teed up another union to block his ambitions.
It was like a game of chess between Juanita and Frank Tiemann. In mid-1975, it seemed like she'd checkmated Frank and he couldn't move.
Rees says Tiemann knew he couldn't dispose of Juanita on his own. He needed help.
James McCartney Anderson, at this point, was the manager of the Carousel. And he employed Eddie Trigg as the night manager for the bar. the VIP bar upstairs.
What was Anderson's perception of himself and his ambitions?
Whatever it took was Jim Anderson's motto. He had no loyalty to anyone. He had become very friendly with the Tiemann family, so much so that he encouraged Frank Tiemann to believe that not only could he be trusted to look after his very wayward son, Tim, but he was somebody who could achieve ends in the Cross.
Mr. Fix-It.
Very much so.
Jim Anderson employed Tiemann's troubled son, Tim, who had a history with drugs.
He'd accompany Jim around the clubs. Jim would do his rounds, go to the Venus Room and the Laramie and just check what was happening. And Tim Tiemann was going with him. They were very close.
In May 1975, about 6 weeks before Juanita disappeared, Frank Tiemann gave Jim Anderson a cheque for $25,000, apparently to buy a club in Bondi for his son, Tim. Some believe this money was a down payment for murder.
In the weeks after he was paid $25,000 by Frank Tiemann, it was Anderson who instructed Trigg to set up the meeting with Juanita at the Carousel Club. This was when she disappeared. Later, Anderson wrote a letter to police saying he had no relationship with Juanita. It was written on letterhead from the Carousel. This was a reminder to police that James McCartney Anderson worked for the power in the Cross, Abe Saffron, and that they should take their inquiries somewhere else, which they dutifully did.
Anderson had form when it came to kidnappings. Just ask Arthur King.
I was kidnapped from my house.
Arthur King was a founding member of the Victoria Street Residents Action Group. In 1973, at the height of the group's activism, he was abducted from his home.
No knock at the door. They had a key.
Right.
What did they say?
I said, get dressed, you're coming with us. I never had any doubts that it was to frighten me off my anti-development activities.
King was blindfolded, thrown into the boot of a car and driven down to the south coast of New South Wales. He was held captive for 2 days, then driven back to Sydney.
They made up some silly story. I said I was to go to St Vincent's Hospital, say I'd had a bad headache and be admitted. As I came out to do that, I saw Jim Anderson standing on the corner making sure that I did what I was told.
So you think Jim Anderson was behind it?
I have not the slightest doubt.
You had the chance to tell the police what had happened and you chose not to. Well, why did you...
I didn't trust them an inch.
With good reason. Anderson was an untouchable of the Cross. He worked for Abe Saffron and he was a close associate of the developer, Frank Tiemann.
It was to Jim that Frank Tiemann had turned when he needed to get rid of Arthur King. That had succeeded. It was again to Jim Anderson that he turned when he faced the problem, this final obstacle that Juanita represented to his future in Victoria Street.
Following the failed inquest into Juanita Nielsen's disappearance, Peter Rees teamed up with Arthur King. And in 1986, they met with the newly established National Crime Authority and told them everything they discovered about Jim Anderson's links to Frank Tiemann.
There was no interest from the National Crime Authority. As we walked down the street after this meeting, I said to Arthur, there's something wrong here.
It became clear to Rees and King what was wrong in 1987 when Abe Saffron was charged with tax evasion.
For 69-year-old Abe Saffron, it was a day he and no doubt many others thought would never come.
Saffron was sentenced to 17 months behind bars, thanks to evidence provided by his former lieutenant, Jim Anderson.
Did you keep two sets of books to keep track of this black and white cash?
Of course.
And did you have custody of those books?
I did.
What the NCA didn't realise was the nature of the man they were dealing with as their chief informant. Jim Anderson burnt them.
The NCA sidestepped the evidence, pointing to Anderson's involvement in Juanita's disappearance. And they ignored claims that Saffron was behind the ghost train fire at Luna Park, which killed seven people in 1979.
I wrote a story with Arthur about how the NCA had put tax evasion ahead of murder.
Next, murder at the carousel.
She'd been shot downstairs.
How do you know that?
As I saw her.
Journalist Peter Rees says that Jim Anderson, in cahoots with Frank Thiemann, ordered the murder of Juanita Nielsen in 1975. But without a body, there was always a knowledge gap. How did Juanita actually die? That gap seemed to close for Peter in 2003 when he tracked down trans performer Marilyn King. Marilyn King was Eddie Trigg's girlfriend in 1975.
He exercised a strength that appealed to Marilyn, and she was deeply in love with him.
When Peter Rees found Marilyn, she was living in New Zealand, and she wanted to set the record straight about the lies she told police after Juanita disappeared.
She told the story about how she'd gone to the carousel on the morning of July 4, 1975, because Eddie hadn't been home all night. So she arrived at the club about 11 o'clock on that Friday morning and asked Loretta Crawford, the receptionist who was there, if Eddie had arrived. And Loretta said, he's upstairs, he's with a woman, he's busy.
Marilyn said she waited 2 hours for Eddie to finally appear, and he urged her to ride in his car to their Elizabeth Bay apartment.
When she got out of the car, she noticed that Eddie had blood on his shirt. Then Marilyn noticed that there was a piece of paper in Eddie's pocket in the shirt. "What's this, Eddie?" she said. And Eddie said, "If the police ask, this is my alibi." "But Eddie," she said, "it's got blood on it." At which point, Eddie tore the blood from the bottom of the note. The importance of this piece of paper was that it was the receipt that Juanita had written for $130 for the ad in Juanita's paper Now. She told me that she saw Eddie's fists. They were bruised, swollen, and black and yellow. Marilyn believed it was a one punch, and Eddie said to her she didn't feel a thing.
Eddie was still alive in 2003 when Marilyn King told you all this, and giving you more confidence was that she was prepared now to make a statement.
Precisely. And in fact, the New South Wales Police flew Marilyn back to Sydney for an anniversary meeting with Eddie Trigg. They wired Marilyn up and they met. Sat at the bar of the Abbott's Hotel in Redfern where Eddie was living, and they sat and chatted about old times. When Marilyn raised it with Eddie, the Nielsen case, what had happened, Eddie just said, "Stick to the story, darling," and said no more.
Eddie Trigg died in 2013, never revealing the full story of his part in the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen. But there is one other version of what happened in the Carousel Club that day, and it comes from Loretta Crawford, the receptionist who greeted Juanita when she arrived at about 10:30 that morning.
The entrance was actually those three whole doors. There was the one entrance to the Carousel Cabaret. There were three small stairs, then a landing, then two lots of stairs going up, which would have led to my office.
Crawford says Trigg and Juanita had their meeting in the upstairs bar, and when they came back down, there was a third person with them. All three went down to the basement, and that's when Crawford heard a gunshot.
She'd been shot downstairs.
How do you know that?
As I saw her.
What did you see exactly?
As I sort of turned to go down the last stairs to the storeroom, she was laying there and this third person was standing there with the gun in his hand.
Loretta Crawford never publicly revealed who the third person was, and we won't either, for legal reasons. And Peter Rees believes Crawford's version of events is tainted because of her affection for Jim Anderson.
She was regarded as some sort of foster daughter. She called Jim father, which was a very strange relationship that she had.
Were they lovers at all?
No. I believe Marilyn King's story to be the truthful one.
Why?
Because it fits. Loretta's story is suspect because she can't exhibit that same degree of trust.
Neither story can be substantiated, and Barry Ward has another version of what happened to Juanita.
Let's make a point here that the carousel scenario, as we called it, was a total fabrication.
Coming up.
We were told she was drugged and violated and then murdered and then dismembered.
And the Eureka moment.
That's a revelation. You've changed my thinking completely. It makes total sense.
The veteran journalist Peter Rees is convinced that Frank Tiemann paid Jim Anderson to make Juanita Nielsen disappear. But talk to Barry Ward, another journalist obsessed with this case, and he'll tell you a very different story.
Frank was a patsy. Actually, Eddie Trigg was a patsy and Frank Tiemann was his understudy. Anderson was involved, of course, but it came from Saffron, not from Tiemann.
Barry Ward says Saffron ordered Juanita's murder after she discovered evidence which connected him to illegal business interests in Victoria Street.
She told of one of the activists that she was onto a big story, something very, very big.
Ward and Reeves were convinced the meeting at the Carousel Club was a throw-off when they spoke to Heather Curry. She managed the waxworks in King's Cross.
She told the story that changed everything. She said that she had seen Juanita long after the last official sighting.
About 90 minutes later, to be precise.
So where did she go, and where was she going when she saw Heather? Well, at that point, of course, when she saw Heather, she was about 200 yards from the Lido Motel, which we knew was a Saffron joint also, of course.
The Lido Hotel, now the Uno Hotel, was just around the corner from the Carousel Club. Abe Saffron owned both establishments. Barry Ward isn't sure how Juanita was lured into the Lido Hotel, but he is sure, once inside, she met a very unpleasant end.
Well, it's pretty horrendous. We were told that she was drugged and violated and then murdered and then dismembered. is a nice way of putting it, I guess.
Ward believes Juanita was put through a meat grinder in the Lido's kitchen.
And then the remains were fed down the garbage disposal unit in the motel kitchen.
Wow.
Ward's primary source for the meat grinder story was Saffron's accountant, Ted Middleton.
And who had told him that?
Well, we didn't ask that question. That's not the sort of question you ask in King's Cross at that time.
When reviewing the case files, we discovered Middleton told police his information may have come from Jim Anderson's adopted son, Grant. So, who killed Juanita?
Well, Cray was the ringleader, of course.
Throughout his career, Fred Cray was one of Sydney's most feared, loathed, and corrupt cops.
Now, this is a really horrible human being. Cray was known to be a torturer. He would kill people, he would make them disappear.
So to be involved in the abduction and murder of Juanita Nielsen would have been very much in keeping with Cray's ruthless style.
Oh, absolutely. You would not put it past him at all. He would be up in the very high apex of your list of suspects there, certainly capable of committing a murder and making a body disappear.
The fact that Juanita's body has never been found has deepened the mystery surrounding her disappearance. The only clue to her whereabouts came 5 days after she went missing, when a handbag and a few personal items were found scattered near the M4 motorway in Western Sydney. Police divers searched nearby dams and bushland in the Blue Mountains. To no avail. Ward thinks Juanita's belongings were intentionally dumped as a diversion by Cray's accomplices.
Well, I think it's obviously a plant. It was a plant to draw attention away from the scene. Cray took the keys from her body, from her person, when she was murdered. That was used to go into 202 Victoria Street.
Ward says Cray and his henchmen were looking for a secret dossier that Juanita had been compiling.
It was an expose on organised crime and corruption, heavily involving Saffron and Anderson, we suspect. Juanita was onto a big story, a very big story, which she was going to publish.
I think that was bullshit. I never saw a dossier. It was long, long mentioned about it. There've been other people that have raised that a mystery dossier. We never talked about it. As far as I'm concerned, she never had it. I think it's a myth of people's fertile imagination, conspiracy theory stuff.
I think David Farrell's right. There's no evidence of a secret dossier. But I think it's time now to reveal my own eureka moment that came in the making of this story. It came when I spoke to Arthur King. In his view, the whole Juanita Nielsen disappearance really only makes sense if you look at the villain who had the most to gain from Juanita going missing.
It's only rational if you look at it from Jim Anderson's point of view. Look at it from anyone else's point of view. Nothing rational about it.
That's a revelation. You've changed my thinking completely. It makes total sense.
What do you think happened to Juanita?
I think she got killed on Friday, the 4th of July, 1975, in the Carousel Club.
Why did they kill her, though?
Well, I believe it was at the instigation of Jim Anderson, who ran the club. And his purpose in doing it was to compromise Frank Tiemann, whose son worked at the club, so he could extract money from Frank Tiemann. The way Jim Anderson made his money running the club was by blackmailing people. As soon as a kid came in and looked like he had some money, they'd compromise him in some way and go to the family and extract money from him.
That's true, because for years, Tiemann did give him money.
Yeah.
How much do you know?
So one amount of $25,000 that was documented.
This was the check believed to be a down payment for Juanita's murder. But we discovered the money was payment to Anderson for a stake in a club in Bondi, where he was part owner. However, the timing of the payment looked suspicious, something Anderson used to his advantage.
From Jim Anderson's point of view, he wanted it to be obvious because he wanted to get money out of Frank Tiemann.
Frank Tiemann was desperate to get his Victoria Street development underway. Anderson knew this made Tiemann a prime suspect when Juanita Nielsen disappeared. And so, for the years that followed, he continued to extort him, up to $250,000, ruthlessly exploiting the old man's vulnerabilities while also keeping the police off the scent.
What was the role of the police in making sure this crime wasn't solved in a few days, as it should have been?
They didn't do the obvious. The police investigation started on Sunday. Two detectives, they interviewed Trigg. If the police had followed up that interview properly the next day, gone back to the carousel, interviewed all of the people who were present on that day, the crime would have been solved in 24 hours. That didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because the police were compromised because of their relationship with the club.
The one with the most motive for me is Anderson himself.
Juanita was onto a big story, a very big story. It was an expose on organised crime and corruption, heavily involving Saffron and Anderson.
Everything circles around Jim Anderson.
He's a highly manipulative human being, would inform strategically against his perceived enemies. He's the man who put Abe Saffron away.
It was his evasion of tax that brought him undone.
Did you keep two sets of books to keep track of this black and white cash?
I did.
Anderson wants chaos. Anderson is building his reputation. He wants people to fear him.
Whatever it took was Jim Anderson's motto.
I was kidnapped from my house. I saw Jim Anderson standing on the corner making sure that I did what I was told.
And then there's the story of her getting into a yellow Ford Mustang.
Yes, it was a story that was put forward by a fellow by the name of Glenn Williams.
A local real estate agent who knew her well said he saw her get into the rear seat of a yellow Mustang or Falcon car.
Glenn Williams, someone who'd negotiated a car lease for Jim Anderson. There was an association proven there.
How many police do you think were being paid or did you see being paid around that time, back in the 70s and perhaps early 80s?
Well, I once said to one QC, how much time have you got?
In 1991, Anderson turned on his old boss in an interview on Four Corners.
What was Abe Saffron's relationship with the New South Wales police like at that stage?
He used to favour certain junior officers and help them through the ranks so that when they got in their position of authority, they could show their appreciation. He was the untouchable. He was a power broker.
However, Jim Anderson was just as powerful and just as untouchable.
He's informing on various people, not just to the state police, but the Commonwealth Police at the same time, and then the NCA later on. So he becomes almost untouchable.
That's right. He's a highly protected figure.
Did the National Crime Authority ever ask you anything at all about the Juanita Nielsen case?
Justice Stewart never asked me any questions about Juanita Nielsen matter.
He played them and got them to fund his lifestyle. He told them that he was at risk. if he stayed in Australia, therefore they had to fly him around the world first class. And he spent a lot of time set up in Manila at the Grand Plaza Hotel. He lived in luxury at the NCA's expense.
Anderson was in Manila when Frank Thiemann received a letter, handwritten, unsigned, from the Philippines. It was from Jim Anderson, and he had a message for Thiemann and his friend Abe Saffron. He threatened to bring them both down by revealing facts about the Juanita Nielsen disappearance, the abduction of Arthur King, and the Luna Park ghost train fire. To quote, "If the other interested party thinks he's only looking at 2 years, tell him to think again about life." This is an extortion letter, pure and simple.
In 1995, Anderson had a heart attack and moved to the Blue Mountains, where he lived until his death in 2003.
This is Juanita's family vault in Sydney's South Head Cemetery. If she's ever found, this is where she'll be interred. But for now, all we have is a small white cross over an empty grave. And whose residence is just over there, overlooking the cemetery? It's the man that I believe killed Juanita, James McCartney Anderson.